Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Today I'm speaking with Helen Thomas, a respected journalist who served for 57 years as a correspondent and later White House Bureau Chief for United Press International. In July 2000, Helen Thomas became a columnist to the Hearst News Service, where she still works. A member of the White House Press Corps, Helen Thomas has covered every presidency since John F. Kennedy and was the first woman officer in the National Press Club. The recipient of many awards and honorary doctorate degrees, Helen is the author of four books, including her latest, Watchdogs of Democracy? The Waning Washington Press Corps and How Does Fail the Public, published by Scribner in 2006. Helen Thomas, welcome to the program If You Love This Planet.
Thank you.
Helen, you and I actually had dinner some time ago where you discussed the fact that you would like to write this book, which you have done. Can you please just tell us the main points that you made in this book, Watchdogs of Democracy, the Washington Press Corps?
Yes. I feel that reporters let the country down by not asking the right questions, by allowing the president to fabricate reasons for going to war. And I just think that they blew it big time. And we're all suffering because of it, and certainly the Iraqis are.
Why do you think, and I watched it too, why do you think the White House Press Corps in particular, but journalists in general, fail to have the courage to step up to the plate, so to speak, and ask the relevant journalistic questions which they're obliged to do as journalists?
I think they were intimidated by 9/11. Everything changed by that horrible catastrophe. Everything that we do, everything way we look at things, and the reporters were afraid of being called unpatriotic, un-American if they asked tough questions. So they towed the line, and I think they were getting some instructions from the powers that be in New York, corporate headquarters.
Why would the corporations want to muffle down, I suppose, the reporters and the truth? Why? What benefit would that be for the corporations post 9/11?
For the same reasons that they all want to play ball with the White House. And they don't want to see to be out of step. I think it's a serious problem that they want to be loved. Unfortunately, they defaulted on their position, which is to ask the challenging questions like why.
Yeah, well, I remember when 9/11 happened, George W. Bush was really not well accepted and his popularity was very low. And then he stood on the rubbish dump at Ground Zero with that megaphone. And suddenly everyone, I think, psychologically thought, well, he can be our daddy, he can be our hero, he can be our father, he can look after us. Do you think that psychological dynamic occurred, Helen?
Well, I think they were looking for, the public was looking for a hero. Mm. And, you know, he placed himself in that role. But everything's been downhill ever since.
Would it be possible for you, with your vast experience of presidents, to describe how you would analyze George W. Bush, Helen Thomas?
Well, I think that he's a very stubborn man, who insists he's right, is intolerant of dissent, and he got us into this muddle, and he has yet to explain why he invaded Iraq. And when you ask him, he'll say 9/11. You say, Mr. President, there were no Iraqis involved in 9/11, and so forth. They use this as an excuse. It's incredible that he's gotten away with all these fabrications.
Do you think, I know he's an incurious man. He rarely reads or really, I think, asks questions in depth. Do you think he knows himself, or do you think he was a puppet manipulated by, you know, the man behind the curtain, i.e. Dick Cheney and Karl Rove and the like?
No, I think he thinks he's president, which is sort of disarming, because he has such certitude about his attitude, and I don't know whether it's self-defense, what he really does think. He says repeatedly, I am doing the right thing. And every book, every postmortem that has come out recently pictures this kind of a man.
He's really, I mean...
The country can't wait.
No. I'm kind of looking at him, I suppose, as a physician. He actually is psychologically, I would say, inadequate. That would be my diagnosis, an inadequate person who got to be president of the United States.
He can't admit a mistake, so he's sort of working around it now by sending more troops in Iraq and so forth and saying we're succeeding. Succeeding to do what? What was the goal? We got Saddam Hussein, and that was being, it's a debacle when you think of the people who've died.
Well, according to The Lancet, the British medical journal, over 1 million innocent Iraqi civilians have been killed, and America, what they don't talk about and what the media doesn't talk about much is the number of bombing runs that America is doing every month, and they've increased this last month.
It's terrible. You know, if you repeat a falsehood often enough, like we're winning and so forth, this has become embedded in the minds of Americans. They don't realize. If you read the newspapers, you'll see how many people are being killed every day through car bombs. And how can we, in the Western world, justify this? That's what I want to know. Mm. And how about the Australians? What do they think?
Well, look, we're in Australia as psychically numbed, I think, as Americans are in your country.
Right.
And do you know, and you would know this, Helen, I think that the media is determining the fate of the earth. And as President Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And if the democracy is not well informed by the media...
No.
Whose responsibility it is to inform people and tell them the truth, then they float along on the sort of air of unreality.
Exactly. Well, they seem to choose to forget how we got into this war, how we continue to aggress and threaten.
I really liked your exchange. You had, I'll just read this out so people can hear it. In a press conference on the 30th of November 2007, Helen Thomas questioned Dana Perino, the White House press secretary, why we should depend on General David Petraeus in determining when to deploy U.S. troops from Iraq. Ms. Perino began to answer when Thomas interjected, quotes, you mean how many more people we kill? End quotes. Perino immediately took offense, responding, Helen, I find it really unfortunate that you use your front row position bestowed upon you by your colleagues to make such statements. It is an honor and privilege to be in the briefing room, and to suggest that we in the United States are killing innocent people is just absurd and very offensive.
I laugh out loud. What does she know? I asked her, for two consecutive news conferences last March, I believe, President Bush said, we do not torture. Then he gave an interview several weeks ago to Martha Raddatch of ABC. And he said, yes, he had signed off on torture. So when I was questioning Dana Perino, I said, how do you explain this? How do you reconcile? And then she gave me a lot of garbage to. And so when I got up, I had no support in the room, although there were several reporters, and they knew exactly what I had pointed out, and they were there and so forth. And so I just looked around, and I said, where is everybody?
They've got no guts, have they? I mean, what's the matter with these extraordinarily...
Some people who heard it on the air said, we're here, we're here. They called.
They called.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it just boggles my mind when I think of the you know, all the news that's fit to print type New York Times newspaper, who published 5 front page articles by Judith Miller, who worked with Chalabi and with Scooter Libby and all the rest, about and Curveball, about the lies that they perpetrated about Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction and all sorts of things, you know, and the Times then later its ombudsman said sort of in a back page article, well, maybe we were a little bit wrong, but they never came out on the front page and said, we helped to orchestrate this war and this killing of a million people.
They did a very small mea culpa. Yeah. They should have been beating on the chest and so forth.
Yep.
They shamed us because they are supposed to be the newspaper representing the truth, letting the chips fall where they may. Very, very depressing.
So, Helen, in your extraordinary career since covering first JFK, have you seen a change in the media's attitude in reporting such events? Do you think they're becoming less courageous, less respectable, not following the ethics of journalism? Do you think that's happening?
I think they've lost their way. I think they've lost their nerve. I used to know great newspaper people, great, great reporters from all over the world.
Mm.
They never would have had bowed and scraped as these reporters are doing today.
What about Keith Olbermann?
I think he's great. I really do. I mean, he says they tell it like it is. He does do that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, if they worry about ratings and how much toothpaste they're selling, you know, he boosts the ratings. I mean, why can't we have people as outspoken on our side, the truth, as that terrible man? What's that radio commentator, the right-wing? Rush Limbaugh.
You know that there was a period soon after 9/11 when most of the liberal commentators, not that there were that many, were wiped out. They lost their jobs.
They lost their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Like,
but you haven't
like
lost your job.
Donahue and others.
Yep. In fact, I think I was the last interview that Donahue did on MSNBC. It was just before, I think, they went into Iraq or just after. And I was to have 10 minutes at the end of his show.
Mm-hmm.
They had a woman who had a pair of Siamese twins.
Mm-hmm.
They kept her on. I mean, not that it wasn't sad and everything, but talking about this Siamese twins thing, and I'm a pediatrician, for about half an hour. And I got about 4 minutes at the end with Donahue. And I think then that I was the last interview that he did before he was fired.
Yes. And so many others, you know. Some have come back and so forth, but it's the word liberal is a dirty word in this country, thanks to Ronald Reagan and perpetuated by his successor, George H.W. Bush, and so forth. And it stuck. I'm a liberal. I'll shout it from the housetop.
But a liberal means, I mean, Jesus was a liberal if you want to get stuck into it.
Absolutely. We care about the poor, the sick, and the maimed. We care.
Yep. And didn't Jesus say it's more difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to pass through the eye of a needle?
Right. It's so sad, really.
Tell us, Helen Thomas, I'm interviewing Helen Thomas, the Dean of the White House Press Corps. Tell us what your impressions were of Ronald Reagan, Helen.
My impressions was that he was certainly a conservative, and he bamboozled the American people in a way with his charm. I don't think that that he really cared too much. I mean, he didn't really make many friends in the White House. And I have to say that he was an automatic conservative, but my whole impression of it is that we didn't really know him. That he was a very, really private, but he was considered a good public speaker. So he was a good public speaker because he had a prepared text in front of him.
His
news conferences showed his lack of knowledge.
Well, I remember that I knew someone from the State Department, and Ronald Reagan was about to visit Central America. And they produced some 3x5 cards, you know, with various data and statistics so he'd know it when he went down there. And they were returned back to the author, "Too Complex, Please Simplify." And he'd already shown it to his 9-year-old kid and said, "What do you think of this?" And he said, "Oh, it's fine, Dad."
I think that his wife was instrumental in a good way in making him go to the Soviet Union after he and his cohorts had been calling it the evil empire. And when he got there, he found out the Russian people were kind, smiled, suffered, and so forth. They laughed, and it sort of struck him how nice he was, and he really was welcome. When we got back, I said to him, "Mr. President, do you think if you had gone to Russia, Soviet Union, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you might have found out that the Russians laugh, they cry, they're human?" He said, "No, they've changed."
Oh, my God. And why, Helen, do you think it was Nancy Reagan who induced Ronald Reagan to go to Russia?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, I think that he was being pushed by his wife and by others, and he knew the folly of the words of having an enemy. And he did meet with Gorbachev, and he found out it was a human being and not a bear that walks like a man.
Yes. Well, remember when I met with him in the White House, Helen, and I spent an hour and a quarter with him literally holding his hand?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I agree with you that he and Gorbachev did work together, and I think that they did help to end the Cold War, and for that we must honor both of them.
That's right. I do give them credit for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I found him very simplistic. I found clinically his IQ to be about an average of about 100, I think. I mean, he knew absolutely nothing about the nuclear arms race, the technology, policies, nothing.
Mm. And he had his advisors who were running the show.
Yeah, he never spoke without 3x5 cards, and they said he used to get them mixed up and greet the wrong leaders at the wrong time.
But he would always smile, you know, and people forgave him for a lot of his
they did.
Lack of knowledge.
Yeah, I used to call him the Pied Piper of Armageddon. Helen, tell us, I'm interviewing Helen Thomas, the Dean of the White House Press Corps. It's a great honour, I must say, Helen, to talk to you. Yes. Tell us about JFK, Helen.
Well, he was my favourite president to cover. I thought he had a great intellect. He had vision. Anyone who would say we're going to land on the moon in a decade, it seems so far-fetched. Was he reading science fiction? He created the Peace Corps. He understood he had come from war. He had been suffering all his life with a bad backache and Addison's disease. So I must say that my hat's off to him in every way. And he inspired love. He inspired people to work for him, and it was his sense of humor. humor was tremendous.
Mm.
He also was the first to really awaken the American people to the value of a news presidential news conference. See him quiz and the great comebacks that he had. They knew that he was on display, really.
Mm.
You must have been, well, this is almost a redundant, stupid thing for me to say, but you must have been, as we were all were, absolutely shattered when he was killed.
The world wept when he died.
Mm.
In darkest Africa, in the most remote places, there were photographs of him. It was phenomenal, really.
Yes, my brother was a diplomat in Iran, in Tehran. And shortly after JFK mm-hmm. was killed, I went to Iran, and in every little shop window or every carpet shop, there was a picture of JFK, just as you said.
Mm-hmm. He struck a chord in the hearts of everyone, really. He was almost the ideal, and he reflected a lot of youth and humor. I mean, his greatest moment, it was the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Mm.
Step back from the brink.
Yep, well, he saved the world.
Yep, and Khrushchev did too.
Yes.
I'll always praise him for the courage of cowardice, in the sense that neither of them wanted to blow up the world.
Yeah, God, thank God. You know, I've read, Helen Thomas, that people are comparing the charisma of Obama with JFK. Do you think that is an appropriate analogy or not?
I think they have a lot in common. I do.
Mm.
I don't just say that one is either. You know, I don't think Obama is JFK yet.
Mm.
He has to be tested more.
Mm.
But I think there are a lot of the characteristics. And they both think. They're both educated.
Yeah. They read. I remember reading...
And they show it.
Yes. I remember reading a piece by a law professor at the University of Chicago who was a colleague of Barack Obama, who said he knows more about constitutional law than almost anyone he's ever met.
He never saw a piece of paper on his desk that he wasn't picking up and reading.
Oh,
reading it.
Really?
Anywhere. I mean, he was so intellectually curious when he was trying to make up his mind about going to the moon. He has the first class of astronauts to the White House and their wives for an informal dinner. And then they mix and mingle. He said to them, Do you think we could land on the moon? They said, sure, absolutely. You never say no to a president. When they left the White House, they said, is this guy nuts? Is he crazy? He liked me, I think, because we would banter back and forth.
Yes. I always felt I was a young woman at that time. I just had my first baby, I think. But his press conferences were so fascinating. He was so highly intelligent, and he would play with you all, and you know, they lifted you to another level, I think.
You're right. He got the country interested in the presidency, really, when he started holding news conferences.
Yeah.
Because the back and forth was so interesting, and there was so much going on.
Okay, now tell us about LBJ.
LBJ, bigger than life.
Bigger than life.
He had to have it all, but he was brilliant as a can-do president. He was not the super intellectual, and he was not Hamlet in terms of trying to decide what to do. But he did so much for our society, called the Great Society. He rammed through Congress within months after taking office, Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, voting rights for blacks for the first time in history, first time in the South, that is, federal aid to education at all levels, from Head Start, which is preschoolers, and college, and on, libraries. Now, he was tremendous in that on the domestic side. But, of course, Vietnam was his denouement.
Yes, he couldn't admit he was wrong, could he?
Right. He, I think he put his whole stamp on history.
In two ways, in foreign policy, Vietnam, and also, and then, of course, he had McNamara as his Secretary of Defense.
Right. He didn't know, he knew that he had to get out of Vietnam, but he didn't know a way to do it with honor, I guess. Whatever it was, he was so anguished. He used to take us walking round and round the South Lawn that we called the Bataan Death Marches. Because we were wearing high heels and so forth, falling all over each other, trying to hear what he was saying. And he was letting his hair down on how he felt. No, we knew what he was going through. We don't know what this president's going through.
So Johnson was really racked with guilt and pain, was he, and indecision?
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Do you think this president, George W., is capable of those sort of emotions, Helen?
If he did, he hasn't shown it. I think obviously he must be troubled because of his low polls, low ratings in the polls and so forth. I'm sure he thinks now that he can't do any right. He thinks that people think he only does wrong and so forth. But at the same time, he has an absolute certitude that what he has done is the right thing. Mm. And he has around him sycophantic people like Condoleezza Rice, I think, and others who just go along with him, even though they may think otherwise.
That leads me to another interesting point, and maybe I shouldn't be saying this, but I know that Condoleezza Rice is close to George W. Bush, and I know that she spends a lot of time at the ranch, or has in the past. They'd sit up all night watching baseball together. She exercised with him in the gym and the like. And I did feel that when he nominated her as Secretary of State, there was a photograph of George Bush and Condoleezza Rice looking at each other on the front of the New York Times. And I have to say that they looked as though they were in love. I mean, do you think there's anything in that, or is that pure conjecture?
I honestly don't know, and I don't think so. I think that she was very devoted. She is very devoted to him. I think that she knows him a lot better now than she knew him before.
You know, it's so interesting. I've been interviewing Professor Ted Postle at MIT about missile defense and the ever-present threat of nuclear war, because the weapons in Russia and America are still on hair trigger alert, ready to go at any minute. And then when you combine that technological, political situation in the world with leaders who arise like George W. Bush, it makes the sort of survive. It's tenuous, isn't it?
If they all have to prove their manhood, macho, I mean, we all may suffer. One thing about Kennedy and Khrushchev, they both knew war, and they both knew the consequences of any act, and both stepped back from the brink. And I'll always praise them as my heroes, really, because they could have blown up the world.
Well, I know Robert McNamara, and he told me about those times in the Oval Office during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he said to me once, he said, Helen, you don't know how close we came. Minutes mm-hmm. to nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
So now, Helen Thomas, the next obvious question to ask you, which is really too awful really to contemplate, I think, but we've got a woman who is running as vice president, Sarah Palin, who clearly has demonstrated that she knows nothing about foreign policy at all. She would be, if elected, vice president to a man who's had four melanomas with metastases, and I speak now as a physician. His prognosis is not good. He could well die in office. So we would need to, I think, conjecture what it would be like to have Sarah Palin as president. Would you like to, Helen, comment on that?
Sure. It would be a debacle. I think it would be catastrophic to have a woman who has no background, nothing. She has no foreign policy intelligence, no background in foreign affairs. But also, she's so far right. She is farther than even McCain.
Yeah.
She's pro-guns, anti-abortion, not anti-evolution, but she wants creationism taught side by side. He's tried to ban books in her little village. Fortunately, the librarian resisted those moves. I think that she is so self-righteous, and she doesn't know anything that would really merit to make her a national leader.
You're on the ground in Washington, Helen Thomas, you know, with your finger on the pulse, really. I'm talking to you from a little fishing village in Australia. Do you have a sense, a prognostication, if you will, of how this election is going to go? Do you have any sense, with Palin appearing on the scene, hundreds of thousands of women just thinking she's the ant's pants, what's happening with Obama? Could you postulate about what you think might eventuate?
I think, well, first, I'm scared of the possibility of this Republican ticket. And also, I think that when people go to the polling place, they'll vote their prejudices. And in that respect, they never would admit it, but there is a race card there.
A race card. What's your assessment of Obama so far?
I think he's a very good man. I think he's intelligent. He has integrity. But I think he may be snookered by the McCain people, just as all the Democratic contenders, candidates have been in the last several years. They stoop to everything.
Well, Carl, it amazes me that Karl Rove, who's been, he should be up before Congress being questioned, is still behind the mechanics and dynamics of the Republican Party.
Well, you can't be far behind. I mean, they're almost neck and neck, both candidates. It's amazing how they have been able to gain. And this Sarah Palin, I guess, has struck a chord. It's amazing, really. She is the antithesis of the whole feminist movement.
Yeah. Well,
but she certainly has profited from it.
She has. I can't help thinking that this is the most important election ever to have been held in the history of the human race, what with global warming impinging upon us at great speed and the ever-present threat of nuclear war. So many catastrophes facing us all. Really, by the misapplication of science, and I speak now as a scientist, and then to be able to elect a president like George W. Bush or like Sarah Palin if she got to be president, or even, let's say, McCain, who has no history or knowledge of science,
right,
to be running the world.
Amazing how little he knows about economics.
Who, McCain?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think Obama knows more.
Mm. Oh, I think he's such an intelligent man. Well, okay, look, Helen, we're talking in the middle of this Wall Street meltdown.
Yes.
Where the insurance company has been bailed out by the American government. It's interesting to me too, and I'd like you to comment on this, that America is such a sort of free enterprise, capitalistic society, but when push comes to shove and the big corporations that are private get into trouble, they get bailed out by the people's tax dollars. So it's kind of socialism for the big corporations and capitalism for all the other people. Would you?
You're right. They're not crying socialism when they're being rescued. by the federal government. They hate any federal intervention on any scale until they need it.
Yeah.
No, it's very contradictory and laughable. I think the country's really worried.
Well, it would have to be, surely. I mean, these corporations are laying off like 40,000 workers.
Right. What's going to happen?
Yeah, what will these people do?
I don't know. And you can see on their faces and in the photographs from Wall Street, everyone's in pain.
I mean,
I don't know.
I don't know how they'll feed their families, let alone pay their rent or their mortgage.
Well, this administration never believed in regulation. Republicans never want any regulation or any discipline or any supervision, oversight. But they are asking for it, and they are suffering the consequences. This is the way it was in 1929. When Franklin D. Roosevelt came in with all these ideas where you had to patch the country back together again, put people to work, even cleaning streets, sending young people to the forest and so forth. Everything was thought of to try to keep people eating.
Yeah.
It was, and the richest people on Wall Street were selling apples on the corner to help to support their families.
You were nine, weren't you?
Mm-hmm.
You were 9 years old. Do you remember that, Helen?
I certainly remember the hardships around me in the neighborhood and the family of six that was getting maybe $13 a week to feed the family, welfare checks. No, we all knew what was going on in a desperate way.
Do you think the situation could develop to become as bad as the Great Depression now, Helen?
I don't know enough about economics to quote McCabe, but I think that it's very bad. I really do. I don't think it's reached that proportion. No one is willing to call it a depression, but a lot of people are suffering. They've lost their home. Very troubling in every way.
It is. Well, I'm interviewing Helen Thomas, who's the dean of the White House Press Corps, and who sits in the front. Have they put you back in the front row now, Helen? I know.
Yes, I'm back.
I know they removed you to the back row and they put a cross over your name so that George W. Bush didn't ask you any questions.
Right.
Does he ask you questions now?
No.
Really?
Well, several months ago, he let me ask a question, but I haven't since then. But I haven't really been attending the news conferences.
No.
Not that I'm boycotting them. They don't have that many.
How often does the president hold a news conference now, Helen?
Well, I mean, he should hold one a month at least. And he certainly is not making that kind of a score.
What about the daily press briefings? That's with Dana Perino or Perano.
Perino. They had those daily briefings. Early in morning, one just as sort of a 10, 15-minute quickie, and then a full-scale briefing at around noon or 12:30.
Do you find them interesting? Are they worth going to?
Of course. Always. Nothing can replace being there.
No.
Do get a chance to ask questions, much as they upset them. And you get the general way the wind is blowing.
Yeah. Get the general tenor. Well then, Helen Thomas, let's go back then to Gerald Ford. Can you give us your impressions of Gerald Ford?
I think he was a very good man in many ways, but he never aspired to be president. He wanted to be Speaker of the House of Representatives. He had strong advisors around him, and he had been in the House for a long, long time. So he basically made a lot of friends on Capitol Hill. But I think he sort of kept the seat warm rather than innovating anything or putting his own But he did, after in the aftermath of Watergate, he restored confidence in the White House and the Oval Office.
Mm. He was a man of integrity.
But I think that, of course, the pardon of Richard Nixon 1 month after Ford became president would not look on without suspicion.
Yeah. Well, we could talk about Richard Nixon. So much has been written about him, thought about him, discussed about him. But it would be very interesting, Helen Thomas, to just for you briefly to give us your impressions of Richard Nixon.
Well, I think he always had two roads to go, and he always took the wrong road.
Oh.
Sort of an overkill. There's no question he could have won easily in 72.
Yeah.
But that's when he started all these machinations, the spying and breaking into the Democratic headquarters and things. It's beyond the pale, and he just crossed the line.
Yeah, he was a strange man,
and
because
he was a walking tragedy, really. And toward the end, very much so.
Yeah,
there was nothing he could do to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Everything he tried to resurrect the good old days didn't work.
Yeah,
paid a heavy price.
He did, and he was a man.
Only president in American history to be forced to resign.
I think he was a man who found it difficult to make friends, too, or have close, intimate relationships. Would you say that?
Oh, yes, that's right. He was basically shy or reserved, however you want to look at it. So he didn't have many close friends. He had a few, and he relied on them. They were sort of cronies, but no, he didn't spread his wings in that respect. He could, it was not very good on one-on-one, but he could speak to a crowd of thousands of people, a typical politician.
Mm. Now we need to talk about President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton.
Well, I think that Clinton missed his chance for greatness. He really, I think he had the intellect, but somehow something happened on the way to the forum. He never quite rose to the possibilities, his own possibilities. And Mrs. Clinton, I admire her for going the whole course in her struggle to win the presidency. And I think that she would have been a good candidate.
What do you think it was about Bill Clinton that did not allow him to fulfill his real possible destiny, Helen Thomas?
I think he didn't know his enemies. He never knew 1 second, and I didn't say a minute, in the White House when he was not being investigated by the ultra-right.
Oh.
Who laid all kinds of traps for him, and he was not smart enough to know that he was being watched and set up.
So he was naive in a way.
Absolutely. He didn't understand that he was not protected in any way.
Like JFK would have known, wouldn't and or Johnson would have realized, wouldn't he?
Well, no, it was a different era. They would have known, yes, they would not have. But they played around, I understand. But nevertheless, the press, it was off limits to deal with their personal lives. In that era, but it's all gone now. The 60s changed all that.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I feel, Helen, that Clinton missed the opportunity with the end of the Cold War to abolish nuclear weapons between Russia and America. Would you agree with that perspective?
Absolutely. It's incredible, you know. There were so many missed opportunities, but it's amazing that we survived, that the atomic bomb has been under control since Truman dropped it, World War II. But there have been many slip-ups that could have led to a total catastrophe.
And those possibilities have not gone away. I mean, we live with that As JFK said, the nuclear sword of Damocles every second of every day hovering above our heads.
That's exactly right.
Well, Helen Thomas, we've finished our interview, and I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. You are one of my mentors, one of my idols and heroes, and honor you, Helen Thomas, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
My guest today was journalist and author Helen Thomas, who has served for 57 years as a correspondent for United Press International.
The excerpt you're about to hear now is taken from a Grand Rounds lecture given by Dr. Helen Caldicott at Victoria General Hospital in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, in October 2008.
I've just revised my book, If You Love This Planet, which was named after the film. I wrote it in 91, predicting from the scientific literature what would happen about global warming, deforestation, desertification, overpopulation, ozone depletion and the like. In that time since 91, everything I wrote has come to pass. And I felt like calling the book I Told You So. I always feel when I write a book, that's it. Everyone will read it. And they'll do the appropriate things, as we do in medicine, to save our patients. But unfortunately, that turns out not to be true. As I revised the book, I read the literature on global warming, the IPCC report, International Panel on Climate Change report, which in fact is 3 years old because the global scientists were so meticulous and pedantic, they went over every single word and every single sentence till they agreed upon it. So it's a little bit outdated. I also read James Hansen's work. He's at the Goddard Space Center, NASA. He coined the term global warming 20 years ago when he testified before the Senate. Hansen's predictions about global warming are more severe than the IPCC. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we had 250 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. We're now up to 383 parts per million. Hansen says we've got to go backwards to 350 parts per million for several reasons. One, the Arctic ice is melting. They've just measured it and it's thinner now than it's ever been. Summer ice melt. It is predicted by some it will be gone in the summer by 2010. Now, what happens is when that occurs, you get the albedo flip. Albedo means that the white light from the sun comes down onto the ice and it's projected back or reflected back into the universe. So the Earth, you know, it doesn't heat. Normally, when the white light from the sun hits the Earth, it's converted to infrared radiation and trapped by the atmosphere. And particularly when CO2 collects in the atmosphere, it acts as glass does in a glass house and traps the infrared radiation. Now, if the ice melts totally, you will get the albedo flip, which is, instead of the white light being reflected back, you've got Black Sea. And the Black Sea absorbs the heat and the sea heats. Right next to that is Greenland. The ice cap on Greenland is 3 kilometres thick. The Greenland ice cap is melting. Rivers are forming on the top. The water's spreading down through the Greenland ice cap and getting to the surface of the rock, which acts as a lubricant. So the ice is starting to move towards the sea. There are earthquakes induced quite frequently now in Greenland by huge glaciers breaking off from the Greenland ice cap. If the Greenland ice cap melts, we're in serious trouble. But the predictions are, even if it doesn't quite melt, that the seas will rise 5 metres by the end of this century. 5 metres is 15 feet. But that's probably minimal. It's probably going to be much more. Now, along with that heating of the sea, and the Antarctic is in trouble too, huge ice shelves are breaking off from the Antarctic. But there's permafrost, and the permafrost has been there for hundreds of thousands of years, and the permafrost has trapped huge quantities of methane. Methane is 20 times more potent as a global warmer than CO2. CO2 is responsible for 50% of global warming, and then if we get the methane released like millions of tons from the permafrost in the tundra and the like, and it's starting to melt. If you go up to Alaska, where Sarah Palin hails from, the trees are sort of drunken trees at odd angles as the permafrost is melting. If the permafrost melts, and the IPCC didn't talk about these delayed effects of the albedo flip and the permafrost melts, we're in serious trouble. And from all indications, it seems like it's happening. So I come to Alberta. This huge city is built upon oil, right? I hear that the Americans have come and taken over most of your oil companies, so you are sycophants to the United States, which burns oil voraciously, as you know. The truth is that you have a huge responsibility. As James Hansen said, we must stop burning coal now. Coal is the most concentrated form of carbon there is and produces huge quantities of CO2. And by 2030, we must absolutely stop burning coal, but we've got to stop burning oil. As the Earth heats, so the oceans rise, so there will be more and more catastrophic storms with greater frequency. For instance, Bangladesh is built on a delta. Oh, and also the glaciers are melting rapidly, so the rivers like the Ganges and the Yellow River, etc., will be drying up. So there will be a huge scarcity of water, B, the oceans rise, catastrophic storms, and places like the Delta will be drowned. And one third of the human race lives at sea level. Some of the most beautiful cities on Earth are at sea level, and they will drown, and we will have millions of ecological refugees, millions, moving into higher territory, into sort of societies which are well-formed and organized, and the ecological refugees will create havoc, of course. The other thing is, as the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer enlarge north and south, and the tropics enlarge north and south, we'll be seeing malaria in Seattle, maybe up here, as the Anopheles mosquitoes breed in their trillions. So we'll get malaria, eastern equine encephalitis, dengue fever, and the like, epidemics like we've never seen before in medicine. Then we can talk about droughts. We're seeing the droughts now in Australia. We're in the middle of a huge drought. Our ex-Prime Minister John Howard wanted to build 25 reactors in a drought-stricken country. Each nuclear reactor uses 1 million gallons a minute of water to keep it cool, and you want to build 4 of them up, ironically, at a place called Peace River. So I really want to lay it upon you as my colleagues that we're talking about the ultimate form of preventive medicine now. We have to stop global warming. Now, people say, well, it's impossible. You know, we have to have energy. Well, first of all, generations of people for, I don't know how long we've been here, 3 million years, 2 million years, lived without electricity. Mozart wrote by candlelight. Shakespeare wrote by candlelight. Yeah, we've gotten used to it, and we turn our computers on, we leave everything on overnight, all those lights blinking, etc. That uses 6% of the power that we use just by leaving those things on overnight. But we can conserve 20% of that which we use. For instance, none of us should be using clothes dryers. We should be hanging our clothes out and drying them with the nuclear reactor in the sky in the summer and in the basements by the furnace in the winter. That's easy. They use up to 10% of the electricity that you use. Why do we use clothes dryers? Because General Electric, which makes good things for life like clothes dryers and refrigerators and washing machines and nuclear power plants and nuclear weapons, has produced a market for their electricity. I'm being semi-facetious, but it's true. There are many ways that conservation can take place, but we can conserve 20% of the electricity we use. I commissioned a study. A year ago, I had a wonderful conference on nuclear power and global warming, and had people from both sides of the issue, including that Patrick Moore man, who I think hails from Canada, who used to be opposed to nuclear power, and then he said he founded Greenpeace, and now he works for the nuclear industry. And We had a very excellent discussion for 2 days, and then finally a man stood up at the end called David Freeman, who used to run TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, who closed down 6 reactors, who worked with Jimmy Carter in the White House and put the solar panels on the White House and turned the thermostat down. He stood up at the end and said, we can generate all the electricity and energy we need with no nuclear and no carbon. And I said, you must be joking. He said, no, I'm not. So I commissioned a study which was done by one of his protégés, Arjun Makajani, called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. And it's very complex, beautifully done, costing everything out. By 2050, America can be carbon free, nuclear free. For instance, we can put solar panels on every parking lot in America, and that's a huge area. They're building cars now, electric cars with lithium-ion batteries that can be recharged 100,000 times. You plug your car in when you go to work, car charges up, you unplug it, and you take it home at night and plug it into the house and charge up your house. It's called vehicle-to-grid, vehicle-to-grid. Wind. You are blown by wind. You know, you've probably got enough wind in this province alone to supply the whole of Canada with electricity. You are bathed in sun, and it's not one source that will provide all the energy that is needed, but a multifactorial source of geothermal, which will provide baseline, and you've got a lot of geothermal here and across Canada. So wind, tidal, solar and the like, and these energy systems are developing so rapidly that Silicon Valley and the entrepreneurs are into it. They call it green energy, not because it's green, but because it makes lots of greenbacks. And that's the one part of Wall Street is not suffering at the moment. I advise you to read this book. In fact, this is the prescription for survival. It's beautifully done, very scientific, and costed out. So when you hear the nuclear industry and the oil industry say that there are no alternatives, they're either ignorant and haven't read the data and literature, or they're lying. This is a medical problem.
That was part of a Grand Rounds lecture given by Dr. Helen Caldicott in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, in October 2008. The report Dr. Caldicott refers to during this excerpt, Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, can be downloaded from this website, www.ieer.org. That's IEER.org.
My guest today was journalist and author Helen Thomas, who has served for 57 years as a correspondent and White House Bureau Chief for United Press International and is currently a columnist for the Hearst News Service. Thank you for joining us today on If You Love This Planet. If you want more information about other episodes or this one, go to our website at www.ifyoulovethisplanet.org. There is also a page on that website for donations. We'd be very grateful if you donated and helped us with our ongoing efforts to interview as many fascinating people as we possibly can. Thanks again for joining us.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.